Good morning and welcome to the conversation. Good morning, Beth Ann.
I guess I have to stop dancing now.
Good morning. I guess you do. Yes, it's time to get serious. No, there's been a new report on carbon levels. In spite of a lot of efforts to keep carbon down, they seem to be up, yeah?
And that is no dancing matter at all.
Exactly.
We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, a report last week from NOAA showed the amount of carbon dioxide reached 400 parts per million in March, the highest global average on record. Samples taken from the 40 areas were analyzed at the NOAA Center in Boulder, Colorado, and levels are expected to peak this month. So what does that new record level mean to climatologists and especially to the rest of us? UH Manoa Professor of Oceanography Axel Timmerman is a researcher at the UHM International Pacific Research Center, and he's back with some explanation. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, you could look last week at sources across the globe, and veritably it was the same article from news service to news service to news service, all saying what had happened, but not giving a lot of real conversation to what this means. For example, when is the last time that we ever reached 400 parts per million?
Yeah, so 400 parts per million is a really interesting number, because when we think about it, last time it was reached was 4 to 5 million years ago. So that was in the so-called Pliocene, a relatively warm period where the Arctic was ice-free, sea levels were about at least 10 meters higher than nowadays, and the reason being that part of Greenland was gone and part of the West Antarctic ice sheet was gone. Camels and horses were running around in the Arctic. Gigantic mastodon elephants were roaming the wild plains of North America. So we had a very, very different planet back then. And it's not a perfect analog, of course, what happened back then, because there were small changes in ocean circulation that were quite different. But a large fraction of this very different planet that we saw 4 to 5 million years ago was due to the relatively high carbon dioxide levels. So we are essentially approaching a level that has been unprecedented for at least the last 4 to 5 million years. And that is dramatic.
And we're doing it quickly. I mean, this is not a matter of gradual change. It's a matter of very rapid change, because looking at even a 20-year or 30-year profile, those numbers have been slowly creeping up, or not so slowly creeping up.
So the pre-industrial levels are 280 parts per million. So mankind has increased the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere by 120 parts per million. And currently we are emitting 10 gigatons carbon per year. And I remember when I grew up, it was less than 5 gigatons per year. So we have doubled the rate of emissions, and there is no decline in sight. So that's a little bit worrying.
And you're not that old. I mean, we should say that you're talking about a time frame here of you're looking at about that 20 or 30-year period.
Yes, a little bit more, but yes. That's right. So this acceleration of carbon dioxide emissions is really worrying, and that's definitely something that, of course, the Paris meeting will also discuss. So what can be done to curb the emission rates? And another important point to keep in mind is, if we really would like to restrict and constrain climate change to about 2 degrees Celsius warming above the pre-industrial average, so that's a threshold or benchmark that people are discussing right now to avoid dangerous climate change, we have another 500 gigatons to go. So even if the emissions were constant at 10 gigatons per year, we have only 50 years to go. But the emissions are increasing, so very likely we are going to hit this 500 gigaton reservoir that's left for us to hit this 2 Celsius threshold. So with increasing emissions, we are going to have perhaps 20 years to go on that. And the available, accessible fossil fuel reserves could give us another 1,000 gigatons. So
I mean, that's a very frightening scenario. And of course, everyone's saying, well, what can be done about it? But before we get to the what can be done, it has to also move into the, do people really understand this? Is the scientific community effectively communicating what this is all about in ways that mean something? Because again, going back to the point of how that report was released last week, where veritably the press release just appeared from paper to paper to paper.
Yeah, I think there are two elements to this. I mean, when I give presentations, public talks, typically the audience is are people that experience a preaching to the choir situation. So I'm not converting anybody, and maybe that's the wrong word, but Certainly, those who are not really interested in that subject, neither want to change nor accept the science, they wouldn't go to these meetings. They are not reading really the climate scientific literature or the literature that's being communicated by journalists and so on. So that this is one element. But the climate science communication has many, many different elements. One of them is, of course, the climate scientists. They need to get engaged much more, I think, and particularly in the United States. But also the journalists have a very important role. And what I see very often is that journalists, on TV in particular, they like to have controversies. But in fact, in the scientific community, there is no controversy about the existence of climate change. So typically, they invite so-called experts, people who have absolutely no credentials in climate research, that are calling themselves experts. And that inflation of the word expert, climate science expert, is something that has really hampered the communication of climate science in the U.S.
All that criticism taken just at face value, looking at how we talk about this in a meaningful way, even a few years ago when, you know, it was 400 parts per million on Mauna Kea, yeah, there was still not exactly a passing nod to that, because we did talk about it, but it didn't seem to translate into a great deal of understanding of, and this leads to that, and then, and then, and then. Mm. Does it need to be broken down in much more, I don't want to say simplistic terms, but at least terms that people can understand in terms of their average and everyday lives?
Well,
how change would really impact them?
Yeah, communicating the relevance of what we are doing is something challenging, because we don't want to change our behavior. So we are a little bit the ostrich putting our head in the sand sometimes, because if we accept the science behind global warming and ocean acidification, of course, it would mean that we have to change, because already right now we are causing climate damage. We are causing costs not only to the United States, but worldwide. And the same, of course, for every CO2 emitting country. So they play a part in the global climate damage costs. And I think at this point, we have to make a decision. Okay, do we want to pay the climate damage costs in the long run? It can be very costly, in particular the sea level rise aspect of it, and ocean acidification too. Or are we investing right now, which would be costly? Yes, a carbon tax, of course, is costly. But at this moment, we have the perfect constellation. We have very cheap oil prices, and we want to stay below 2 degrees Celsius to really avoid this dangerous climate change. So it's not like turning off the radio when you go out of your home. It's not that kind of decision. It's a much more important and radical decision that people have to make in their minds and in their behaviors. And I think that's something that's very difficult to implement in daily lives and so on. But it's on everybody's responsibility to contribute to really making this place, our planet, a better place for future generations to come. And it's about responsibility to children, to grandchildren's generations, and so on. And keeping in mind the CO2, the 400 ppm that we have in the atmosphere, even if we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, which is, of course, not the case, this CO2 would linger in the atmosphere, extra CO2 would linger in the atmosphere for another 1,000 years.
Axel Timmermann, thank you so much for coming in and giving this some context.
Thanks very much, Bethan.
Axel Timmermann is a UH Manoa professor of oceanography, also a researcher at the UH Manoa International Pacific Research Center. The center's mission is to provide an international research environment dedicated to improving mankind's understanding of the nature and predictability of climate variability and changes in the Asia-Pacific sector.